This is a unique vector of a Linux documentation for RSR, and this means that I just can't present this at Microsoft. Showing this slide at the wrong place is really getting in trouble. Okay, so I want to speak to you about the Bayesian learner, and I want to tell you why it's optimal for a multi-binary search, and I'm going to define everything. And then the second part of the talk is going to have some computer applications, where I'm going to use the first results to speed up quantum binary search in this standard setting when it's just here from quantum binary search. And it's all work with Mike Ignore, my advisor from the Hebrew University. Okay, so the talk is going to have basically three main parts. The first part is going to be a survey of the problem, and I'm going to speak a little bit about some results that people already have. The second part is going to be a classic part, where I'm going to present my algorithm, and I'm going to give you an intuition for why does it work. It's not going to be a complete formal proof, but at least I'll try to give you some intuition. And the third part, I'm going to talk about some quantifications, which are better algorithms for binary search, and better lower bounds for some cases in quantum binary search. And I guess I want to restart my computer right now, so wait a little. Okay, so let's just dip in. And like I said, the first part is going to be the second part. Okay, so let's just begin with seeing what's binary search. Okay. Basically, the idea is that we have a special element, S, and we have a list of sorted elements, x1 to xn, and we want to find where should we put S. Okay, so we want to find two elements, subset S between xi and xi plus 1. And this is the standard model, and what we're dealing with is a generalization of the model. And in the generalization, sometimes you get a wrong answer. Okay, so in the standard model, the way we find out where we should put our element S, we just compare it to elements, right? We ask, well, whether S is larger or smaller than X7, whether it's larger or smaller than X7. And we're dealing with the generalization of the model where some of the comparisons may be erroneous. There's been a lot of literature on the subject of binary search with wrong comparisons. The most common model is for adversarial comparisons. That means that I'm asking a question, and there's an adversary who's telling me the wrong answer, and the adversary's goal is to make me not find the right place of my element. And this model has two submodels, where the first submodel, the adversary can lie to me for a certain number of time. Okay, let's say the adversary can tell me log n over 4 lies, or something like that. While in the second model, the adversary is limited, and he can only tell me a constant and only a constant selection of the questions I've asked so far get wrong answers. Okay, so that means that, let's say in the second model, the adversary is allowed to lie in 10% of the questions. Then the first question has to get the correct answer, and also the second, and then question number 9. And in question number 10, he can actually tell me the first lie. And if I already asked m questions, I know that I've only heard most m times p lies, and p is the ratio of the lies that the adversary can tell me. And both these models have been studied extensively in the literature. The problem was first proposed by Clayton Mayer Rivest and Malcolman actually presented it in 1978, and the first journal paper was in 1980. And they had a special solution for the problem, but where they could only deal with a constant number of mistakes, of lies. So only there's a very, very weak adversary. He can't really lie too much. And there's been a lot of work, and in 1903, Borgstrom and Krasoraji, and I think I'm pronouncing the names right, actually they gave a very good algorithm for the second case, where the number of lies is bounded. And they showed that it's possible if the chance for a lie is, if the number of lies is less than 1, they can actually solve the problem log n over, it should be minus half squared lies, I'm sorry, here, half minus b squared lies, that's a typo. And in 1999, Droti gave an algorithm for the general case. There's a general when the lies can be anywhere the adversary wants them, and this is their complexity. And if you really want to read about this,
a lot of literature that we felt through the survey in 2002, really writing about many other instances.
Where does this arise? Why are we interested in this?
Okay, that's perhaps a question. First, the reason we're interested in searching
ordered lists is because many of our data structures are ordered lists, and you really want to find something as quickly as possible. I don't know, even when when you're looking for a name in the list, what you do is you search this. And the motivation for LIES, the original motivation, was not in the adversarial model, but actually in a noisy model. And it's very important for learning. Because when you have learning, any computer science learning algorithm usually gets some wrong errors. And you want to be able to find the right result, even though you have some wrong answers. Actually, in everything which is experimental, is sometimes you get wrong results, you still want to be able to figure out the difference. So the really important motivation was not this adversarial model, but the noise model. And I'm going to talk most of my work about the noisy model.
Subroutine, but likely be noisy.
Right. For the quantum case, comparison can be subroutine. And something which is going to be amazing, that, or at least surprising enough, that even when you have noiseless quantum comparisons, even if you had a noiseless quantum computer, it's going to turn out that the optimal thing to do
is to do, well, not, I won't say the optimal, the best thing we know to do today in order to search quantum lists, there is no noise and everything is perfect, is to do some heuristic procedure, which gives you a very good success probability, but it's not 100% sure. And then to use it within this sort of framework, which deals with algorithms which might have a failed probability. And that would actually give you a better result than the best known quantum algorithm, which really gets everything done in 100% for every state. And this is really quite surprising in a way. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the noise model. In this model, each comparison can be wrong with some probability 1 minus p. And it compares with corrective probability p. This is really the interesting real-life model. First, I want to begin with some intuition regarding what should be the complexity of any algorithm which can solve this problem. So the intuition says that there's supposed to be some information theoretic lower bound of log n over 1 minus h of p, where h of p is the entropy function, minus p log p minus 1 minus p log 1 minus p. And the reason for that intuitive lower bound is that, well, let's say that I have n elements, and I want to find a certain element. Well, there are n elements, so if you want to know which one is the right element, that's going to be log n bits of information. And let's say that I'm trying to send you which is the right element, right? I'm the oracle, you're asking me questions, and I'm giving you answers. And I'm trying to tell you where is the right element, but every answer I'm sending you, every comparison only has a probability of being correct. Okay, so you'd expect, I just Shannon, to meet me about log n over 1 minus h t, because that's the information I'm actually sending you, and I have to pass you log n bits of information. So what we want to do is we want to keep that intuition in mind. What we want to see is something about log n over 1 minus h of t, and well, you know, prove lower bounds, we're going to show a lower bound which is a little bit less than that. It's going to be log n over 1 minus h of p minus some very small term. And the algorithm is going to be a little bit more than that. It's going to be log n over 1 minus h of p plus some small editor term, like plus O of log n or something. Because, you know, when you have to deal with entropy, you always have to take some squares because you really never get the right results. You always have that log stuff. It's just always you. The intuition should be that this should be the right result. This is the result that we're going to be aiming for. And the noise model, which is, like you said before, the more natural one in a way, was studied by Fager, Rachman, Peleg, and Uphoff. And they gave an algorithm which was very, very complex. And basically what they did was they asked every question many, many times until they got a very, very good success probability. And then they did something which travels sort of the search tree in a very complex way. And they hit the right big O notation. they got log n over p minus half, which is above log n over 1 minus p. But they had a huge constraint. And the reason for that was because they really, I mean, they didn't really solve it. What they did was not really solve the problem. Ultimately, they just passed it to some other problem and solved it. And it made it very, very inefficient and very not what you'd expect from information theory. And because that it's such an important problem for real life, it becomes interesting even after the paper. Javed Aslam from MIT wrote his thesis on the problem. And what he did was basically he took all the possible algorithms for adversarial methods and analyzed them when there's a noisy model. And he got better results than these results, but he still got really terrible results. And it was left a really important practical question for computer scientists, especially in areas of learning and everything which has practical data in it. Okay, so before I'm going to present you all the algorithms, I'm going to generalize the question a little bit more. And it's going to be very important for the quantum study. Is the generalized question. The idea is that sometimes, instead of asking one question at a time and getting an answer, I'm asking a few questions at a time, and I'm getting a few answers at once. Now, ideally, I wouldn't want to do that, right? Because if I can ask a question and get an answer, I can use the answer to ask the second question in a more intelligent way. So you wouldn't want to do it. But sometimes, you're in a situation where you can simply ask a few questions together for free. The physical model, which does not involve computation for that, is internet traffic, where you have packets of data. And what happens is that you don't, I mean, you ask a question, which is packet of data, but inside a packet, it's like an IP packet, you can put many questions. And when you get the answer, you can get many, many answers, because there's a lot of place in every packet. And you want to minimize the number of packets that we're sending, but you don't care if you use up all the packets or just part of the packet. So in a way, a very real-life scenario would be to solve the problem when you can ask a few questions at once. And okay, this is going to be like this. And besides the fact that it's really the real-life scenario for computer science, this is going to be what we're going to need for quantum. And this is like, well, the reason I got interested, that was the quantum stuff. And that's like the real part. And the quantum stuff, we're just going to turn out that we can actually ask queries at once. I think that's better stuff to occur. So formally, what we have is we have the special element S, our special element from before. And instead of asking Dora for whether S is larger or smaller than X, we're actually sending K indexes, I1, pi, K. And we're getting, as a result, a segment, right? And what's the oracle is telling us S is between xij and xij plus 1. So for example, if this is our array of elements, this is S is the right element. In the previous model, what we do would ask, is S larger or smaller than x11? And let's say that we got the right answer to this thing. So the oracle is going to tell us S is larger than x11. Or the oracle can also tell us the wrong answer, right? We compare S to X3, and the oracle is going to tell us that S is larger than X3, which is a mistake, right? Because the oracle can be noisy. In the new model, we don't compare S to C element, but actually we give the oracle a set of indexes, 4, 9, 16, 18, 37, and just, you know, pick up numbers at the top of the head. And let's say that the output is S is between X3 and X20. This time, the oracle got it right. Okay, we're kind of like this. Maybe, again, it's going to get something wrong. I don't know. Indeterministic oracles. But the idea is that the oracle is going to give us a composite answer. It's going to tell us between any two elements that are special elements. And this also can be made noisy. Okay? So what's going to happen is the oracle can either, with some probability, return us the right segment, whereas the element we're looking for. And with some probability, the oracle is just going to return us a random segment. And it's going to cause the element in the wrong place. And what we want to do is actually we want to solve this problem optimally. And after we solve this problem almost optimally, we're going to use the solution to this problem to improve quantum binary search. Yes?
So another way, if I implement the parallel query to the Oracle, the UNA index is, and for each index, it tells you whether it's less than or greater than that index. That seems to be a powerful chest because we can see contradictions.
Yep.
So we could, if you've got a contradiction, it's only less than 16, but also greater than 22, you can say, I know there's an error here. Whereas here, there's no circumstance.
You're right. And it's very interesting too, because it turns out that both models, if you get a single segment or you get a error, both models are not equivalent. And it turns out that you need different algorithms for each model. And it turns out that the model which you need for the quantum phase is the model where you get a segment. Because what we have, what the quantum procedure is going to bring us, I'm going to go into that later, but there's going to be some quantum procedure. I get a few indexes, and it's going to bring us a segment set. So that's the reason I've been working more about this model. But actually, the other model is a very interesting open question. And I have some preliminary results of that, the model you presented. But it's still open, and I'm going to talk about that later in the open question. It's really interesting. And I should also say that all the algorithms and which I read in the literature don't work well when we have that sort of shape. Okay, you can imagine the thing is pretty large. And the quantum case I'm going to use A86. Okay, so they're not optimal with respect, not, I don't know, let's, I'm not going to say optimal, but if you don't have good behavior with respect to K, then you really can't use the algorithm. And existing algorithms, they're real bad when it's hard. Okay, so now I'm going to go over our results, and I'm going to try to tell you what they are. First, I'm going to give you just a broad overview, and then I'm going to really tell you the details about the results. So first, the first thing is basically an almost type, up to polylog log n terms. It's not factors even. Algorithm for the noisy model, which is then. The second result is actually a generalization for the algorithm for the composite Fourier model, where you have the indexes. And still, it's going to be tight, up to a small log n term. And then we're going to use both models to get a quantum search algorithm with Fourier complexity 0.31 log n, which is better than what's been known before, 0.43 log n, and we're going to go into that later. And it's going to give us some better quantum lower bounds for a noisy quantum search, and for quantum search, which is allowed to give a wrong result. And it's going to be better than existing lower bounds. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you the exact results. In a way, this slide is less important than the former one. I mean, the important thing to remember all the time is that we want to get log n over 1 minus h of t. And, you know, all the terms that are going to follow are the log n terms and that sort of stuff. I mean, if you can follow it, it's nice, but if you don't follow it, it's less important. The important thing is to get the information in the radical term right.
And you add the term?
I mean, that it's a function of them, and the function I'm going to show it in a second. The exact function, because it's really complicated. Okay, so the first result is that we're successful against 1 minus the right element can be found with an expected number of queries, log n over 1 minus h of t. And, well, it's already asked, so I can just show you the exact dependency. The exact dependency actually depends on delta. You can either get a dependency where log 1 over delta is multiplied by log n, or you can pull a tree from the algorithm in order to get a dependency when there is a log 1 minus delta term being added, but then you have to pay with this term becoming log to the fourth power instead of log n. So there's a small tweak. But really, the important thing to notice, to understand, is again, you have the log n with the 1 minus h of t, which is an important term. The mistake probability goes like log 1 over delta, which is what you'd really expect, because what happens is that in order to get
This is usually pretty small, but if you want to build it very large, let's say you want to be sure to build 1 minus 1 over n, you'd have to ask at least log 1 over n plus bc, because otherwise everything else you could have done was just wrong. So this term is also pretty logical. And this term is just something that adds up in the algorithm. You're not sure, and you have to make some precautions. So this term is the less interesting one.
Yes, that's important. That's important very well. And there's also communication complexity lower bound, as I said before, of log n over 1 minus hp minus 1 over delta over 1 minus hp. There is some delicacy here. The communication complexity lower bound is correct not for for an expected number of queries, but rather if you know that there's another this number of queries, its success probability
is at most 1 over delta. Most 1 minus delta. And it's not really important for the talk, but it's not exactly the same thing. And you can also, I mean, this is for the exact number of questions, and this is the expected number of questions. Okay, but you can play with them. You can also get this type of bounce, this bounce, or the other way around. Okay, for composite comparisons, what you get is basically the same thing. The only important thing to notice is that in the denominator, we had 1 minus h of p before, okay, because that was the information we got every query. This time, we have composite queries, right? We're sending k indexes, and we're getting segments. And the amount, what we're saying is we're using all the information we're getting, okay? Yes.
I was thinking about the last thing you said in the previous slide. Does that mean that if I were to have an optimal algorithm and I were to run it on, you know, many instances, and then if I take all the instances where it took a, where it worked very fast, basically where it expected things, sometimes it takes more, sometimes less queries. We'll select on all these less queries. I then know that in all of those, that at least a fraction delta of those cases must be wrong.
Yes, and well, you couldn't do it on this algorithm because this algorithm really takes the experience very well. It doesn't go with the experience. All right, partly. Specifically, this algorithm, my algorithm, 100% does not go with the experience.
It always goes at least over log n over 1 minus h of p.
Each individual amount of my algorithm takes more than the information. But yes,
if I had an algorithm that occasionally worked very fast, I would know that the times when it worked fast,
it wouldn't have enough information. It would have to be a guess because it wouldn't have enough information. Okay, so
now I want to pass to the compass question. And for composite questions, the only difference basically is that the amount of information I get each query changes. Okay, so I note by I of q the amount of information I get each query, which is log k. Okay. The nice thing about that is it really reminds me that 10 minutes has passed, so I can plan my time better. So this is actually quite good. Maybe I should do it every time I give a talk. So. Okay, so basically, the amount of information I get is roughly log q minus h of q, okay, where the amount of log k, sorry, minus h of q, where basically the reason I'm writing it this way is that what I presented before was actually a little bit of a simplified model, right? In a simplified model, you make a comparison, get a segment, and it's either correct or with some probability q it's right segment, or with some probability it's just a random segment. But actually, sometimes we get even more information than that. Sometimes we get a segment, and then we know that with some probability q, we got the right segment. If some probability q, the right segment, is the segment right after it. And if some probability 1 minus q minus p, we just got a random segment. Okay, and the only thing you really have to remember out of this is that the algorithm which I'm going to present just utilizes all the information given to it. Okay, and that way, whatever quantum information I can feed in, whatever correlations, whatever information I can feed in, the algorithm just uses all the information it has to get the best possible bounce. Again, up to small terms, which we care less about them.
various kinds of involved.
Okay, I'm sorry. So what I said was I denote HQ to be the entropy of the distribution.
Oh, right, okay.
On the segments. If there is just one segment which is correct for the and okay. For this one minus speed segment, then this would be the line of the position. And if the distribution is different, then the line of the position is going
to be different. Okay, so up to now with just a survey of all of the results and a description of what I'm, of, you know, my results, the previous results, and the problem. If you have any questions, it would be a very good timing. Now to talk about the algorithm, how we do it. Okay, so instead of really showing you the algorithm, I decided to begin with an example. Basically, the example we're trying to find a special element. There are n is equal to 10 elements because, you know, I can only count the number of factors. So I decided to take 10 elements. And there is this special element, and we want to find the special element. And the question is, how are we going to do it? Okay, so the intuition is we're just going to do a standard binary search anyway. Okay, so what do we do in the standard binary search problem? We just compare. We have an element, like say we have 10 elements, and we want to know if our element is in the bigger half or in the smaller half, right? So we just compare it to the fifth element, and then we can see if the start is in the fifth element, we know that we should look at 6x, 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 10 of the second half, and if it's smaller, we should look on the first, next to 6x5. And then we just divide the segment we have from 2 all the time until we get a segment of size 1, and we know where our element should be. Okay, and that's the approach for binary search when there's no noise. Basically, what we want to do is just follow the exact same approach for the noisy protocol. Okay, so instead of dividing it in just in the middle, we're going to begin by defining a probability distribution, which is going to be what's the probability for our element to be in the ith place. Okay, so if we have 10 elements, and we begin with a flat distribution, we know nothing. At the beginning, our element has probability of 10.1 to be each one of the elements. Okay, and now we want to ask a question which is going to give us the max amount of information. So we're going to cut this array in half. Okay, what do I mean when I say cut this array in half? I mean we're going to compare it to x5 because this is a half the probability that our element is here, and there's a probability half that our element is here. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to compare our element to x5, the middle element. And then we're going to get an answer, okay? And it's going to be a noisy answer. And let's say that we got this answer. Okay, our element is on this side. Okay, so we know that we got an answer. We know that it's noisy, right? So we can't be sure that our element is not on this side, but it's more probable for our element to be on this side. So what we basically do is just update the probabilities that we have, just like in the Bayesian approach, the standard Bayesian approach, and we just update all the probabilities. Okay, now we want to reiterate our algorithm. Okay, this time we're not going to ask here, right, because we're not sure. There is still a probability that it's here. We're going to again look for the cut and ask if we compare our element to the middle element just like we did before. Okay, so this time the half is going to be here, and we're going to compare our element to x. Okay, because there's a probability for half to be on the left side and a probability for half to be on the right side. Okay, and after we compare, let's say we got the right answer again. This seems to be our lucky day, so we can say that something's wrong in the algorithm. So let's say that we got the right answer again. Then we just update the probabilities again. And we just iterate this until we have a very, very large element. And with very, very high probability, the element we're looking for is going to be near the high element. And that's basically the entire algorithm.
That's an excellent question. The reason is that let's say that we have an element, and this is our element, this is the element by theory. Right? We're going to ask many questions. Very high probability, you have to know the algorithm. But with very high probability, we're not ever going to ask between the two elements. So those elements are going to be the same type. If we ask between, there's some probability that we get the wrong element, get the wrong side, this element is going to turn higher for exactly the right time when we solve the algorithm. So what we're actually doing here So we're not finding the right element, but we're actually finding some surroundings for the right element. And then we search the surroundings recursively to find the right element. And the reason for the log-log n term, which you've seen before, is that we don't really find the element, we find some sort of surrounding. And then we recursively run the algorithm on one small surrounding, and that will give us the log-log n term.
Sure.
I always get these in terms of factors. The log-log n term, well, which we had in the complex.
Okay, so let's just, you know, describe the algorithm formally. So first we begin with defining an array of probabilities, right? An array A1 of AN of probabilities, with AI being the probability for our element to be between XI and XI plus. And okay, now this is some sort of technical thing you'd want to think. I have a problem. I want to cut the array in half, right? But sometimes I can't cut the array in half. Okay, because, you know, there's some big element, and I can't cut it in half. So I'm going to define something which is some global constant, which I'm going to talk to you about later, called f from par. And par comes from partition. And the basic idea says that if there's an element whose probability is bigger than f from par, I'm going to stop, and with high probability it's going to be the right element. And if there's no such element, then I can cut it in a half, and when I say half, I mean, well, both sides, the difference between both sides is going to be at most epsilon par. Okay, because if the difference is going to be, if the difference between the sum up to the point k and the sum up till then is going to be less than epsilon par, I can just pass an element from this side to this side. Okay, so unless it's a very empty element which is bigger than epsilon par, I can always partition it such that the difference between both sides is at most. So basically what I'm doing is I'm checking if there's a heavy element. I'm going to call a heavy element an probability atom. So if there's, first I'm checking, is there a probability atom? If there's a probability atom, I'm just going to stop the algorithm, and I know that it's going to be in the surroundings of the atom. And if there is no such atom, I can just cut the array into two parts. I can choose k to be xk, the one I'm going to compare to, such that the sum up to k is going to be roughly a half. And the sum from k to the n is going to be roughly x. Okay, so I'm going to choose that sort of thing. I'm going to compare to x. And then I'm just going to update all the probabilities which I have. And that's going to be, and then I'm going to iterate this, and this is basically going to be the entire algorithm. And the only two things to have that is, well, what's the constants, right? I mean, it's not going to be like 5. It's going to be a function of n and p and that sort of stuff. What's going to be that epsilon? And how large is the surroundings? Okay, if I'm telling you that I found an atom in its sphere, now you have to search the surrounding. So if the surroundings is too big, complexity is going to be terrible. So we have to make sure that the surroundings are not going to be too big. These are basically the important questions that you want, we have to answer right now. Okay, I have a formal description of the update procedure, exactly how I do it. But we're not going to go over it because I'm going to want to use time later for other things that's more important. And you'll just have to believe me what I'm saying is standard base update procedure. There's really nothing that's in that. And it's, if you don't know base formula, it doesn't really matter. I just update the probabilities correctly. I have new data and I use it to help my way to update this. It really doesn't matter for the interest. Okay, so now I just want to explain you why does this work. Okay, any questions on the algorithm? Because that's really important.
So I'll try to explain
you
to prove you that it works.
Just wave my hands in a way that might convince you that it works. Basically, the proof follows the entropy of the array I defined A1 to AN. And there are basically three main levels. The first premise says that if the entropy is low,
behind some certain threshold, there's going to be an atom. The second one says that whenever we call the order code, the entropy is expected to decrease with some constant R. And the third lemma says that when the algorithm calls, with very high probability, it calls for a good reason. The element we're looking for is there. Okay, so they basically start with three levels. Right? You have the weight process.
The entropy decreases all the time, so you have to prove the entropy decreases. You have to stop it. And when your entropy stops decreasing sometimes, we have to prove that when the entropy stops decreasing, with hyperobility, we got the right result. Okay, and these are the three lemmas that you want to prove. Okay, so, and they're also written. Okay?
Okay, so we'll begin with the first lemma.
The first lemma says that if each I, AI is small, that means that the entropy is large. Okay, and you can also say it, if the entropy is small, there has to be an element I such that AI is large. Okay, and remember, if we have an element I such that AI is large, we just stop the algorithm. Okay, so this basically says the algorithm is going to stop. And this is an algebraic proof of it, but you don't have to follow algebra in this first paper. There's an intuitive proof, which is more, which I like more. And the basic idea is saying, well, this log 1 over epsilon par is the mean entropy. Okay? And we know that the entropy is always greater than the mean entropy. Okay? And if all elements are going to be smaller than epsilon par, then the entropy has to be, when the entropy has to be larger, and then the mean entropy is going to be at least log 1 over epsilon par, and the entropy is always larger than the mean entropy. So actually, it's kind of logical. And if you don't believe, you know, mean entropy stuff, you can just follow the algebra. It's also very simple. Okay, the next lemma is actually the hardest lemma in the paper. It's technically the hardest lemma. Basically, what we have to prove is that the expected entropy decreases all the time. I'm gonna sort of present a proof for this lemma, or at least for the next time, how to prove it. But it's not very important to follow all the details. The important thing to know is that the entropy decreases and that it decreases well. That means it decreases in almost one minus h of p every step, and that would give us the bound on the number of steps. But it's not, you don't have to, I mean, this is really a lot of algebra, and it's not really important to follow it. And I'm going to need some more notation, which you can speak in after the next slide. So again, if you don't follow this, it's okay. Basically, let's assume that I'm comparing S my special element to xk. And if xk is larger than S, we're going to say that f is equal to 0. And if it's smaller, we're going to say that f is equal to 1. And this can be noisy. And if a1 to an are the probabilities of the elements before the update, we more or less a1 to bn be the probabilities after the update. It's not really probabilities, it's actually random variables, but we're just going to Okay, so let's just give you the result. And instead, what we do is we just write the entropy after we do the update procedure. And the entropy after the update procedure is just the entropy if we got a 0 times the probability we got a 0, and the entropy if we got a 1 times the probability we got a 1. And once you just do the algebra, and we're not going to do it, you just write that this is the entropy decrease. This is the entropy decrease, which is basically h of something, which is a little bit sticky, plus h of p. And that thing here, h of p plus y minus p, is actually a normalization factor. Okay, and actually, the only important thing to know is written here, and it basically says that this sort of stuff, this case, is pretty close to 1 if you cut it in the half. I mean, if you just take the array of probabilities, cut it exactly in the half, and this is equal to 1, and your entropy loss is going to be 1 minus h of p. And if you didn't cut it exactly in the half, but somewhere close to the half, it's going to be pretty close to 1. And we're not going to go over the exact dependency because there's no time, and it really doesn't matter here. But the important thing to know is you lose about 1 minus h of p entropy every step, and that's the reason the algorithm is going to end pretty soon. Yes.
Yeah, dumb question. If your posterior distribution is going down by 1 minus h of p every time, it's limited. Okay? Total entropy is, if it keeps going down at a constant pace, okay, so if it's got a flat, your rate of entropy gain has to flatten out.
Okay, so that was exactly the first lemma. I'm just sorry for it. I don't want to go into it. The first lemma says that if the entropy becomes smaller than rho of 1 over epsilon, the other is constant. Okay. That was now another one. Okay, we said if entropy goes below rho of 1 over epsilon, it's going to be at the element. If there's at the element, the other is lost. Then number two says entropy of time t
is roughly equal to entropy of time t minus 1 minus 1 plus h of t. Right? The initial entropy is roughly, is log n. Right? So the algorithm is going to stop after log n divided 1 minus h of t.
Maybe I'm wondering, it seems like that. You're saying that the rate of information gain, the rate of entropy decrease, is linear.
Right.
And
what's
that?
Until this cutoff.
Let's say that I make that cutoff, you know, my final epsilon is very demanding, right? It's, you know, point. I wait until I have 0.999.
Yes, but this one is not really one. This is dependent on the epsilon. Once you get, you won't. What you get here is not a one. What you actually get here is something which behaves like 1 minus some function of epsilon. And if your epsilon is going to be very dependent, then you're not going to get a constant decrease. You can choose either the high threshold or get a constant decrease. What I do is I put a high threshold, and that way I get the constant decrease.
Okay.
But it's really real. Okay, so. For the third lemma, lemma number one,
lemma number two proves that the algorithm is going to stop after a certain time. Now, the only thing we need to say is, okay, we proved that the algorithm is going to stop. We proved that we're going to have a pretty high element, but why should it stop with the correct answer, right? Why should the right element be in the vicinity of the atom, the high element that we already have? I'm not going to prove it, but I'm going to give a pretty good intuition, which is going to be pretty close to the proof of this lemma. Okay, so this is going to be a proof by contradiction, anyway. So let's say that the algorithm stopped. We have this element here. It's very big, right? It's bigger than epsilon par, because that was made the algorithm stop. There was a very, very big element. And this is our special element. This is a part of the vicinity. Actually, I just drew one half of the vicinity. There's also another half here, but I didn't draw it. Okay, and okay, so this element is very big. And this vicinity is also very big. It's the size is L, the size of the vicinity. This means that in the vicinity is going to have to be some element AK, which has to be very small, right? Because the vicinity is large. So at least, and not all the elements inside this large vicinity can be large. At least one of them is going to have to be at most 1 over 2L plus 1. Okay, because I mean, otherwise, is the probability to be 1. Okay, so look what we have here. We have this large element here, and we have this small element here. I wonder if this. Okay, wait, this is better. Okay, so we have this small element here, and we have this large element here, right? Now, how come the one element is so small and the other element is so large? The only way such a thing could happen is if there were many comparisons between those two elements, right? And most of the comparisons told us went this way, right, went this side, and a very large fraction of the comparison went to this side, right? Because this element is small, and every comparison tells us to go to this side, makes this element large. And every comparison tells us to go to this side, makes this element large. Okay, so there had to be many, many comparisons in the area. Most of them had to point into the large element. But now you got to think about it for a second. This is very, very, very unlikely, because all these comparisons were in the area pointed in the wrong direction, right? Because the right element is here. And most of the comparisons pointed this way was the right element, but then pointed to the wrong way was the wrong element. And now all you have to do is you have to, you know, fix the right values for epsilon r and for l in order to make sure that this probability is very small. But that actually gives you okay, and this is the probabilities, but we're not going to go into that right now. Into the exact values of the numbers, but you just have to pick the right values for it to fit. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the generalized model. Okay, so in the generalized model, we basically run the same procedure. Okay, I'm not going to go over it again, but we just run the same procedure. We divide the array into k parts, k equal parts, and I say equal, I mean with the same probability. And we just ask, we divide it into k plus one parts, and we just put three bars, and we ask which one is the right segment, and we update the basis. We do everything just like we did before, and all the proofs behave just the same way. And it just works the same way as before, and we get an optimal algorithm also for the three bases. And now there are a bunch of details which we can talk about, but we're not going to talk about. There's a reminder to the quantum part. But don't worry, we're going to get it. It's not a very short, the quantum part is short, and we're going to make it. The only thing I'm going to say is that the implementation is not horrible as it might sound. There are implementations, and really the algorithm is pretty efficient. Okay, so before we go to the quantum results, are there any questions on the classical algorithm or?
Okay, so again, all we have to know now for the quantum part is that we have a classical algorithm which solves the binary search problem optimally or almost optimally, even if we can ask k queries any time. Okay, this is actually going to be enough to understand all the quantum results, which are in. Okay, so some history of quantum binary search. Perhaps the first paper for binary search, but quicker than the classic one, was by Alfred Goldstone, Goodman, and Sutra in 1999. And they actually presented two algorithms. The first algorithm they presented was an algorithm which could search a very short list very quickly. Okay, they presented an algorithm search a list of 52 elements using just three queries. And what they did was they just applied the algorithm recursively. Okay, taking, let's say they had a very large list, they just take two representatives out of the list. They would compare, they would run the algorithm to know between any two representatives is the right element they're looking for. And then they're going to take this segment and they're going to run recursively. And using this algorithm, they managed to search an ordered list using 0.53. Log n quantum queries. And what actually happens there is there's an optimization problem, and that's what managed to solve. And actually, it's a very good question, Y52, because it was later improved by Jacob, Vandal, and Brooks to find the right element out of 484 using four queries just by solving the equation for larger values. And later, by Childs, Vandal, and Perillo, they improved it in this year to 0.433, again, by applying some dynamic programming and solving the optimization problem for larger values. It's just a heavy optimization problem. However, they also presented another algorithm, which is a lot simpler to solve for small values, which is because I had to program it. So also glad that it's simple. And basically, the other algorithm I presented was a sort of greedy algorithm. And the idea was this. You just take a bunch of elements you want to find the right element in, and you find out which query would bring you to the highest scalar, to rotate in the optimal way to get near the elements you're looking for. I'm kind of waving my hands like that. But basically, what you do is some sort of the best rotation possible for every query. And you just compute for every query what would be the best possible rotation to do right now. And that makes it pretty simple. Because what you have is you have a bunch of elements, which is a constant size list of a very large one. And you just check out of a finite number of elements, which is basically rotate them in the optimal way. So this is they work exactly. That makes it a little bit harder. But the algorithm, when you just try to rotate it, has a scalar probability. And that was also presented in the 99 paper. Also, there are some lower bounds.
There is a lower bound of 1 over pi ln n by a Hoyer near vacancy for quantum binaries. Okay, so what do we do? Basically, what we did was just take the quantum algorithm, the greedy algorithm by first now, and we just plugged it into our scheme of noisy binaries. Okay, so all you have to do is just compute the algorithm for limited values. It's very easy because it's a greedy algorithm. You just add any query you want. And we just plugged it in. And this algorithm gives you some probability distribution over the elements as far as you want to find your element. And what we did was we solved the algorithm for constant values. And we just plugged it in our classical scheme, which uses information optimally, and which chooses the representative optimally, to get a faster quantum algorithm for binary search without any probability for error. And what you see here is the graph of probabilities you get from a Frankel's algorithm for a limited value of 1024 elements with three queries. This is just the probability distribution you get. We used it for 2 to the 26 elements with 7 queries. And it's just so high that it cuts the graph. It's just, it doesn't look. And what we did was research 226 elements using 7 queries, and it got us 22.3 bits of information per query, which is just enough to get 0.312 log n queries for research an element. I'm just going to say that the probability for success in the subroutine we took was 0.6. Okay, it's not a very high probability. With probability 0.4, you don't get the right element. Right? And still, it turned out to be much better than other algorithms. And also, in our subroutine, we didn't just use the information of which is the right element. As you can see here, there's some sort of probability distribution, right? There's a very high distribution to get the right element, but there's also high distribution, a high probability to get elements near the right element. So we actually used the entire amount of information we got to get those 0.31 numbers. So we thought we'd get a number which is a little bit less good.
If it succeeds, but it only succeeds.
If it succeeds, if you get the right result, you actually get more. If you get the wrong result, you get less. What you get is an expected distribution. That's when you update your distribution.
So what does it mean to say the probability for success in our subroutine is 0.6?
The probability to get the right element. I mean, let's say that I had a quantum algorithm, which would be a very good probability of bringing either the right return segment. The right segment is either the one return or the one after. Okay. I'd say this probability is great because there are millions of elements. Okay? This probability is great because it gives you a lot of information either here or here. But if you just ask what's the probability to get the right answer, it will be 50% if you just say probability. Right.
So the entry of the 26 variant, that graph, actually have a 60% probability of getting exactly the right answer. So it's very, very sharp.
Right, it's sharply peaked, but you still have some information in the rest of the data. It's not just.
It seems like since your subroutine is using 2 to the 26 elements, it seems like the sub-exponential factors you're going to do are in practice. If you're using it, if you're searching a database less than 2 to the 26 elements, it's not
going to
take 0.313 log n
queries. No. Yeah, it's going to. You're right. If there's less than 26, you can actually get 0.35, I think, or something, just by searching about 400 elements or something. Get improvements pretty quickly. Maybe if you search about 400 elements, you still get improvements to this algorithm according to the process. I wanted to push better than 1 over 3. And it's easier to push it because 3 algorithms
are easy to code it, check for larger values. But the first way. Okay, and using this algorithm, we could also improve the quantum lower bounds. Basically, there is a lower bound for quantum search when the algorithm is allowed to ERP. Okay, and it's also the Fermi-Ubic supercomputer. They show that even if the algorithm is allowed an ERP probability of delta, then this could be this is the number of these needs. We have this factor of 1 minus 2 to the square root of delta minus delta. And this is only true for a delta which is smaller than a half. So basically, if you have a quantum algorithm, according to this lower bound, a quantum algorithm which is a million elements and gives you the right element in one query for delta 0.4 is possible. And this is what I'm trying to say, that this bound is pretty weak if we're talking about algorithms with not a very, very high statistical ability. And what we did was basically improve this lower bound to this, which is which has meaning for every value of delta. And the way we improved the lower bound was basically saying, well, let's say that we had a quantum algorithm which is pretty good. So we had a quantum algorithm which had a very, very, which gave you a lot of information and had some limited success probability, but it was still very, very good. Well, you could plug it into our scheme and get a quantum algorithm which is better than 1 over pi ln n for a search. Okay, so because we have some sort of implementation. So we actually, what we did was we used their lower bounds for the base case. And we did this basic procedure to get better lower bounds when there is very high probability of error. And also, the same sort of stuff works for noisy quantum algorithms. We also improve the bounds for noisy quantum algorithms. Great, right on time. Okay, so it's really 5 o'clock, so if you have any questions, please ask, and if not, I'll just go over the many open questions which are left.
Speaker, speaker, and then we'll put forward questions.
Basically, the first thing you want to do is asymptotic analysis of the degree algorithm, which we have proposed, and it's a very interesting question. Another thing is that I didn't go over the greedy algorithm, but it's really greedy to mean that one has a high success probability of the query. But what we need is not this, we're using all the information we're getting. So if we get a greedy algorithm, for example, getting the most information, the highest amount of information, minimizing the energy input, it would be better for us. Then we could get an algorithm which recurrently tries to maximize the probability to hit by segment or the segment after it, or something like that, it would still be much better for us, and there's a lot of I should also notice that I can't read the charts together with reporting, prove that you can't improve the lower bound of Fermi-Ubic machine using adversary methods. And this upper bound of frequency is very heavy and has, I'm certain this could be a way of. Another open problem is actually what you presented. What happens if you get k independent answers? You get c inside, but actually k independent answers. What would be the option? And I have some preliminary results to that, but it's very interesting.
And we showed that any invariant algorithm with low enough success probability can be made exact using smart theories. Now, applying the bounds right now, applying the technique by Andrew right now doesn't work because in order to get this very, very small success probability, scalar probability really has to be many cases. And maybe his results improved or our results in order to get an exact algorithm. This is another interesting problem.
Any other questions? Yes, thanks, speaker.